Why don't we start? Can someone move the minutes from the last meeting?
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Davids, is that you? All right, Representative Davids moves the meeting. Any discussion? Minutes from October 30th, any discussion? Hearing none. The minutes are approved. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. The minutes are approved. All right, we're going to start today. I think we're going to start with Greater MSP, if you want to come forward. So this is in one of our charges of this group in the statute is to conduct research, it says. I'm not sure how much research we're going to be doing, but on economic matters and on the state of the state's economy. And so that's the gist of today. We're going to have Greater MSP here, which focuses kind of on the metro area. We're also going to have the Center for Rural Policy and Development, and then DEED will be here as well. So, welcome to the committee. How are you?
Good, Speaker. Good to be here today. To all the members of the commission. My name's Michael Langley. I'm the president and CEO of Greater MSP. We're pleased to be asked to come and share our point of view on the state of the economy. Prepared to go through that and kind of talk a little bit about our mission, our role, and what we're seeing in terms of our job to market and promote the 16-county metropolitan statistical area called Greater Minneapolis-St. Paul. So thank you for the opportunity. First of all, I mentioned what we see as... Hang on. Our region... 16 county MSA. This year we have recalibrated, we're up to $220 billion in gross regional product for the MSA. If we were a country, we'd be the 41st largest economy in the world. So the point here is that we have a huge impact on the global economy. The global economy really looks at this region as a meaningful area of the world, and so many of our great industries and activities that we have here in the region make us really impactful on so many levels. At approximately 3.4 million people, that $220 billion significantly over-indexes that population growth in terms of the amount of economic activity we see concentrated in our region. In terms of performance, we have the lowest unemployment rate of any major metropolitan area in the United States. The last results at 4.7% versus the national unemployment rate of 7.3%. And compared to other major metropolitan areas in the country, our rate of GDP growth last reported 2012 was at 3.9% versus 2.5% nationally. So clearly a region that's performing well in terms of our amount of economic activity and growth. The reason is you can see here just by a sampling of our great companies and organizations that are driving our economy in the region. We're very proud of the performance of our economy and those companies and those workers and residents of Minnesota that are producing that economy. In terms of what we call regional sectors of strength, these are the areas that are producing that growth and that economy. These are our primarily our areas of cluster activities that we focus on and as we market and promote the metropolitan area. Happy to say that these line up very well with the state's perspective on its areas of strength, its sectors and clusters. We work very closely on a regular basis with the Department of Employment and Economic Development on these projects. And although we may categorize in terms of larger areas of activity, it really covers the same nine areas of sector strength that the state promotes. And also, This week, the University of Minnesota, the Humphrey School, is publishing their report on cluster competitiveness, and happy to report that our focus on these activities along with the state are lining up very well with the work of Lee Munich and the folks at the University of Minnesota on clusters of strength and where essentially we think we should compete and can compete successfully on a global scale. The work that we're doing along with our partners, as we are a 501c3 partnership, a public-private partnership, with the vision that we be globally recognized as this leading economy. The mission is very straightforward. Our job is to work with our partners, public, private, and institutional, to accelerate investment and job growth in our metropolitan area. We do that as a partnership in three ways. We understand that we need an aligned economic development strategy, in other words, these sectors knowing where to compete, how to compete. We actually are responsible for the branding and the marketing and the telling the story of our region, both to ourselves, nationally and globally. And finally, to work with our partners to coordinate job retention, expansion, and attraction efforts. In that work, we really have two conversations. From an internal conversation, it's about product improvement and of our regional product. We are selling and promoting our region, and so continuous improvement of our product, like anybody who has a product or a service that they're selling, is absolutely important. And so we appreciate the opportunity to dialogue with you on ongoing efforts to continually improve our product that we're selling here, which is our region. And externally, then, our job is really to be the voice of the region in terms of that marketing promotion activity. So we have those two conversations going on constantly with our partners internally, and then, of course, externally, we talk of our strengths and our successes that we want to continue to promote as a region. As far as we've been around now for two full years, we just reported out at our annual meeting last month that our partnership, again, our public and private partners working together, have been involved in projects, in essentially to date approximately 50 projects that have produced stimulation of over 9,000 new and additional net new jobs to the region, with an average salary of over $54,000 and over $1 billion in new capital investment in these projects alone. Our outreach with our partners is extensive, both nationally. As you can see, we made multiple market visits to many of these areas around the country, talking to corporate real estate executives, site location consultants, and companies about investing in Minnesota, investing in the greater Minneapolis-St. Paul region. Also, on a global scale, we traveled with the state trade office, with Governor Dayton on all of his trade missions, but also we maintain now offices permanently in Shanghai, China, Osaka, Japan, Munich, Germany, and Toronto in Canada, where we have continuous marketing and lead generation activity going on there for investment in our region, for both bilateral trade and investment activities. So our future, we believe, is bright. We've got a lot of work to do, but this is our story that we believe that we need to tell not only ourselves but tell the world. We really lead the world in most critical areas of economic need over the next 100 years and beyond. That is in the food, water, and health solutions area. We're also very excited about our opportunities to engage in the business services around all of those areas, because we have the R&D capabilities, the industries, and the leaders in technology to support those industry sectors that are so going to be most important to the world. We also have, we believe, a highly educated and culturally connected workforce that exactly creates that success. It's not without our our educated workforce that these things will happen for Minnesota and for our region. And, of course, the infrastructure that we need for the quality of life and the social consciousness, progressiveness, and collaboration that will sustain that success. So our story is that both business prosper here and people prosper here, and that's really the success story for our state and for our region. Our strategy going forward has been really a hard work by a lot of connected public and private leaders this year as we envision what our next 3 to 5 years of our economy is going to look like and why this is a timely discussion. We think there are areas that we need to focus on, and the headlines that came out of our strategic planning work over the past year is, number one, we've got to do a better job collectively of telling our story and rallying ourselves around these key elements of our success for the future. We believe that through our partnership we can build also a strong competitive intelligence capability. We believe a deep and broad understanding of our economy in a way that's going to help us compete strongly against other regions of the world for our investment and jobs. And that aligning priorities together, public-private institutional priorities together, we believe is the way that we can get there. The biggest headline that came out of the work, however, has been the fact that it's all about our talent for the future that's going to drive this. There's no way we can achieve this success without continuing to invest in our human capital and our workforce of the future. So strengthening our entire human capital pipeline has got to be a priority, a number one priority for our region and for our state. That falls into three key areas: talent development, talent alignment, and talent marketing or promotion, meaning that our education system is our primary point of view for talent development. Investing and continuing to invest in our education system has got to be priority number one. Talent alignment is our workforce development system. That's where our state partners, our local partners, and businesses need to work together even more successfully in terms of ensuring that the skills that we need for our jobs in the future are the skills that we're preparing our students and our workers for. And finally, we know that this is a very competitive landscape for talent going forward, especially in the 25 to 34-year-old age group cohort that's the future of our workforce. And so we're competing against other regions and other countries around the world for this talent. So having a really embedded talent retention and attraction approach to ensuring that we have the talent for the future has got to be part of our marketing work going forward. And finally, we need to claim global leadership in those industry areas where we know we're leading and have an opportunity to lead in the future: food, water, and health. We need to grow the intersections of those areas, which are really areas of strength, and we need to target even more the high opportunity areas that we're seeing emerge. The steering committee work that we did, just show you the names of the people that were involved so that you can see that we had public sector leaders, private sector leaders, and institutional leaders working together on this strategy. And this was the steering committee. We touched over 1,000 individuals and organizations in gathering information to help us define that pathway forward in terms of, you can see, regional focus group surveys, sector leadership groups from each of our industry sectors, and partner engagement from all of our public, private, and institutional partners. In effect, the strategy shows us that we're motivated to act on opportunities, not crisis. In terms of global scale solutions, we see opportunities like water purification, filtration, our water vertical, as one of our key opportunities for the future. We know the industry, and we have the talents and technologies to do that. Our agricultural production, our food storage and transport, and our healthcare process to reduce costs, improve quality, both for med tech and improved nutrition, are global scale solutions that we, more than any other region, and certainly in our country and maybe in the world, offer. The intersection of those areas of strength, healthcare and IT, is a huge intersection that we possess in terms of our economy that can lead the world. Robotics and agriculture, again, our technologies and our strengths of agriculture are combining in the future. And then big data, Our IT of food, our IT of health, and our IT of finance will provide us big data solutions for all of those industries. We find that we're stronger as a region when we partner statewide in our sectors. If you look at the agricultural, food and agricultural vertical that we possess in Minnesota, those activities that are in the metropolitan area and those activities are in greater Minnesota, working together, we have a huge opportunity to even be stronger in working our regions together. And we've, out of 300 sectors of our economy nationally, we focused on 27 of these opportunity areas that we believe that we possess significant strengths and certainly higher than normal activity levels of those particular sectors in our region. Those are our strengths, but we also know that we must act with urgency. We have significant issues as a region and as a state that we must focus on. In the area of achievement, only 16% of black students are considered college-ready compared to 61% of white students in Minnesota. We know that this is an urgent issue that both business, government, and our institutions have got to focus on. It's an urgent issue, and we can't wait to solve it in our state and in our region. We're a net talent exporter, not by a significant amount. We have thousands of students and workers that come here every year. We also have thousands of students that graduate and leave here every year. We're a net talent exporter. We've got to turn that number around. We believe that by retaining and attracting more talented workers through our efforts together, we will not be a net exporter of talent over the next 3 to 5 years, that we can actually move those numbers in our favor for the future. In terms of low population growth, we grew 10% in our state from 2000 to 2010, between the last census. However, Phoenix grew 29%, Dallas grew 26%, Atlanta grew 24%, Seattle grew 13%, and D.C. grew 16%. So we need to understand that continuing to grow our economy is going to be dependent upon the workforce and its growth as well. And then finally, entrepreneurship, I have a question mark. We're one of the most innovative regions in the world. Our patents per capita is at the top of the list on a global scale. However, our new business starts rank very low. So we have some question marks in terms of our entrepreneurial culture and reinvigorating it for the future. And I think that's also an area that we need to work together on to ensure that we're offering opportunities and stimulus for our entrepreneurial economy in the state. Because if we don't, we know what the statistics show us for the future. In the next 10 years, if we go on the same course that we're on now in terms of the number of trained workers and talented workers produced by our region that are currently coming here, we'll have a gap of about 120,000 jobs just in the next 10 years. That gap in terms of our workforce shortage by 2040 could grow to as many as 370,000 workers short. That's why it's so important that we retain and attract more workers in the future. It's a challenge that we face together. Finally, again, this is a global market that we live in, and these are global issues that we're facing. In terms of our demographics, the emerging middle class on a global scale will exceed consumption just as that emerging middle class in places like China, India, and the developing nations will exceed the U.S., Japan, Germany, U.K., China, and France's economy together. And by 2050, people 60-plus will make up 22% of the global population. That's double today's proportion. That's a good thing for us in many ways in that we have an opportunity with our industry strengths of healthcare, water, and food to really be responsive to that and to create solutions not only for ourselves and our region but for a global economy. Over the past decade, in terms of technology, trade flow has increased 1.5 times GDP. But information flow has increased 10 times. The Internet of Things will be 35 billion devices connected to the Internet within the next 5 years. So our technology leadership, again, puts us in a better position than most economies to succeed in the future. The lifespan of S&P 500, the S&P, was 45 years old in 1955. So in 1955, an S&P company would be on the S&P list for 45 years. In 2009, that had gone to 17 years only. In another 10 years, it'll be in single digits. What that tells us is our economy and our industries are changing dramatically. Professor Miles Shaver at the University of Minnesota indicates that of the 20 Fortune 500 headquarters companies that we have here, we've created 55 Fortune 500 companies since the 1950s, but we've lost 30 of those. So the dynamics of industry is changing dramatically. We have to stay ahead of the curve and understand where our industries and the jobs for those industries are headed. And then finally, in terms of climate and natural resources, we know that there's going to be a 40% gap between global supply and demand for water by 2030, unless we better deploy technology and improve our resource management. So that's why this whole water and food element is so important that we possess that strength. So how can we work together, public, private, and institutional organizations and leaders? We think on telling the story, we need to work together to equip our regional leaders to tell the story, to tell about our strengths. We need to establish measures and regional success indicators that we all agree on. We invite the legislature to work with us on defining those metrics and those indicators that we should most effectively look at together. We want to prioritize talent together. We need to create this regional talent attraction and retention program. Greater MSP is willing to play our role with our partners to do that. And we need to connect and integrate our region's human capital initiatives, get both public, private, and institutional leaders more engaged in that end-to-end process on development alignment and attraction of talent. And then we need to work together to ensure that our regional economic research and analysis priorities are in place, both public and private together. And finally, that we work together to build these sectors of strength for global leadership in the future. I want to appreciate the time you've given me to share a little bit of my ideas about the economy with you today and what it means to us to work together to achieve success for all residents of our state and our region for the future. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and to the witness. During the session of 2013, the Greater MSP ranked the following factors. You listed number one, geography and market, number two, workforce, number three, business climate, number four, incentives in the testimony before the Jobs Committee. Mm-hmm. And at that hearing, it was stated that Minnesota's existing economic development tools need modernization and revision, and its economic development toolkit is uncompetitive, and real-world experience shows this negatively impacts our ability to retain and attract jobs and capital investment. I was just reading what the testimony was. How did have the conclusions changed any? This was before we had passed the tax bill, and with the tax increases on our businesses, would you revise those statements at all, or are we getting better or worse, or how have the tax increases affected the business climate? And then also, if you could follow up, I'm very curious about, and this was not a doing of the state legislature, but with the Obamacare medical device tax, taxing our medical device makers, have they reacted to that? And are they moving some offshore operations, or what's been the response to the Obamacare medical device tax?
Well, on the first question, I would say that, in general, those factors have remained the same, in terms of experience, both, not only in our state but on a national level. Those factors, regardless of tax rates or actions by legislators from one year to the next, those factors generally will stay the same. Markets are always number one. If there's a reason for a company to be located in a location because of access to markets or customers or suppliers, that will always be the first factor on where investments are made. The second factor always remains talent. The first question and the last question that we're ever asked when we talk to a company that's here and is looking to either expand or grow here, or a company that may not be here and is looking for a region where it wants to make an investment, the first question we get asked is, do you have the quality and quantity of talent, of human capital that we need to be successful? If we can answer that question yes, then we get on to things like the cost of doing business, what our tax and regulatory environment is, what our incentives are, et cetera. But without that human capital at the forefront, we're not competitive. So I think those other factors, they're obviously very important. We look at probably 25 or 30 factors in every project that are important to the decision makers, whether it's the CEO or the board of directors or their consultants that are helping them make those decisions. All of the factors that you indicated are very important. Certainly the cost of doing business and our tax and regulatory environment are important. But we look at the whole picture, and we try to perform as well as we can across the board. And I think, you know, we're a competitive state across the board. We want to continue to be competitive. We need to continuously improve our tax and regulatory environment, our cost of doing business, just like we can need to continually improve our education, our infrastructure, our transportation systems, et cetera. It's not either or, it's both and. And I think that's the best approach we can take to selling and promoting our state and our region for success in the future. As far as the Obamacare issue, I'm not certainly an expert on Obamacare. We work very closely with our business partners from the Life Sciences Alley and the Biobusiness Alliance of Minnesota. I would refer your question to them directly. I don't think we've seen enough trend on either our tax decisions of last session or the effects of Obamacare for the future to really understand exactly what effect it's having on our economy on a long-term basis. I certainly have heard episodic issues of individual companies or individual organizations stating what they think it will cause in terms of positives or negatives in the economy, but I don't think we have the trend data yet I certainly can't report on any trends at this point with either of those questions, either our tax decisions from last session or Obamacare and its future for the state at this point. And again, I appreciate the question.
Mr. Speaker, I wasn't talking about Obamacare and the negative effects it'll have overall. I was just specifically looking at the medical device tax, because that's a big industry in this state, and I was just wondering if we'd seen any movement on the I wasn't talking Obamacare in general and what it's going to do and what's coming, but I was talking more about the medical device tax. Can we keep those jobs here, or are they going to be offshore so they don't have to pay that massive tax?
Well, I think the jury's out on specifics on that. I do know that we have seen continued investments in the medical device and medical technology sector in the region in the last couple of years. St. Jude Medical made a significant expansion, and Medtronic, 3M, and others continuing to make investments in our state and our region. So are there effects? Absolutely. I think that, anytime there's an amount of pain applied to a particular industry versus across the board, it creates problems and issues. But I think we don't have the trend data. I don't have the trend data to really report on that at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Congressman Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I actually got two questions. One, you said we need to do a better job of telling our story. And near the conclusion of your comments, you were talking about what I will talk more cooperation, coordination, public-private sector. What do you see as the next step in terms of telling the story so that it's not simply a dialogue internally, but we get that story told in the other markets of the country and even internationally?
Well, I think certainly from the perspective of our responsibilities as a regional organization, we're investing our resources in that, our marketing and promotional efforts. As I mentioned, we have externally four offices internationally now where we're telling that story more effectively. We believe the first step, though, is to educate ourselves, to educate our leaders, both public, private, institutional leaders, what the facts are more readily, and to give them the tools that they need, whether it's social media tools, whether it's ability to link to the information on their own websites. You know, as we market and support this story to talent, both our students that we want to, we've got to tell them better that we want them to stay. If a student gets out of college and thinks the next best thing for them to do is move to the West Coast or the East Coast, we've got to change that dynamic. We've got great jobs and economic activity here in Minnesota. We want to keep those kids here. So we've got to give ourselves the tools to tell them the facts and tell them the stories more effectively. And I think we're starting to do that. And through Greater MSP, through the Itasca Project and the leadership of a business community, we want to partner with the state even more aggressively on those opportunities.
And Mr. Chairman, my second question, you referenced new business starts and said we were quite low in that category. My thought was kind of the flip side of that in terms of how successful those starts are as opposed to other places where
right.
they may have more starts but a higher failure rate.
Right.
If you have any comments on that.
Regard. Yeah, I do. And I think that's the reason I went on that point where we said entrepreneurship, there's a big question mark. We have a real mixed bag here. A lot of people will say that the reason that we showed so few new business starts comparatively to the rest of the country was because we had low unemployment on an overall scale, and we had a more successful economy than some other areas. And so in many cases, when you're successful, you don't have as many new business starts. Had we been in a real – had our recession been even deeper, we may have had even more people who were leaving their jobs, starting new businesses. So the rate of success versus failure doesn't come out in that statistic. So I agree there are many factors about how to measure the level of entrepreneurial spirit, the level of entrepreneurial culture. And I think that, the types of companies, the large corporations, global corporations that we have here, have spun off so many new businesses and new opportunities. You know, out of a handful, two or three medical devices companies, we now have literally over 600 medical devices companies in our region now. You won't see all those statistics on small business startups. They may not have probably gone through the SBA programs or some of the SBDC programs. They started through another methodology and sometimes don't get picked up in those statistics. So I think, overall we have a very proven track record of entrepreneurship and innovation in this region. We should celebrate that and build on it. But we do have challenges that we need to face along the way as well.
Senator Hamm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Langley, I'm a little confused, I guess, to the response to the question that Representative Davids asked and some of the things that you presented. But just to be a little more clear, is it your opinion that the taxes that we passed, the business-to-business taxes in particular, have been helpful and conducive to growth in the economy? Is that your opinion?
No, sir, that's not what I said. I said we don't have the data at this point to determine what the the specific effect on the economy is. I certainly have heard from many businesses that they are concerned about any business-to-business tax, any tax on input to production is concerning to business. But as far as what the net effect or the effect on our economy is, I can't report on that at this point.
Mr. Chairman, just have any businesses talked to you about that they have changed their plans in terms of investment and growth in this economy as a result of those taxes? Have you not heard from any businesses who've told you that?
Personally, I have not sat down with a business and talked about those issues specifically. Episodically, I have heard from other business associations and folks on who have met and sat down with businesses. We did 537 business retention visits this year through our partnership, and the statistics from those meetings are collected, and we trend that data, and so we'll be reporting out. The Grow Minnesota organization, which is part of the state chamber, is part of that partnership. They will be reporting out on their data on what those businesses told them, and we'll be doing the same after the first of the year. So hopefully there'll be some more information on what the trends are of how business is reacting to specific issues within the lawmakers' control. But as far as there have been episodic discussions about this company was upset, and so they're looking at expanding somewhere else instead of here. But as far as our activity and our results that we've seen in 2013, it's been a very positive experience. Many companies have expanded. We've had a number of relocations to the state from outside the region. So, again, you know, the long-term effects of the business climate and of cost of doing business are certainly concerning, and we want to make sure that we're as competitive a state and a region as we can be, and we need your help to ensure that we get there.
President Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And to Mr. Langley, I'm going to ask you a question about your slide about our region's story, which is on page 8 of our handout.
Okay.
And you talk about a highly educated and culturally connected workforce, and you talk about social collaboration. And I want to tell you that I've had the good fortune to visit a number of biotech, both startup and other companies, over the summer and fall. And I was visiting with an entrepreneur who is actually trying to make small lab technology. It was super interesting over in the district I represent, over in the enterprise labs area.
Mm-hmm.
And he had started companies in California and other states in the nation and came back here to Minnesota talking about a couple of factors that he thinks makes Minnesota stand out from his perspective as a business person. And one was our educated workforce. But the one that he talked about more was Minnesotans' nature toward collaboration, social collaboration, and risk-taking. And those are the things that he looks to as differentiators in the climate here. And he did speak specifically about the tax, taxes here, and he said that's not our issue. What makes Minnesota different and unique is this element of social collaboration and the risk-taking behavior and cooperation. So I am curious if you can talk a little bit more about the slide and your notion of social collaboration and what would put that at risk here in Minnesota.
I want to make sure I'm on the right one.
Thank you. Our region's story is the title.
Oh, our...
One. You just went by it.
Which one is it? All the way back?
Okay. There you go.
Oh, okay. Sure.
The third bullet.
Right.
And it might be too big a question for you, but I think it's important if we understand what makes the region and Minnesota unique.
Yeah. I think that, you know, as a transplant to the region myself, I've lived in, I was a naval officer and a Navy pilot, and so I moved around quite a bit during my career. And I had an opportunity to live both on the East Coast, the West Coast, and kind of North and South in the United States. So from my own personal experience, one of the things that I'm most impressed myself with about Minnesota is how many opportunities for social and public interaction we have here. I think that just some of the associations and groups that I work with on a regular basis now are indicators of that. If you look at the Itasca project and you see what happens there, where we have business leaders, government leaders, and philanthropic leaders and social services leaders all sitting around one table in the region addressing the most important issues that we face as a region. That's an indicator of this social collaboration. We're not just focused on dollars and cents, and we're not just focused on infrastructure alone, or we're not just focused on educational performance alone. We're focused on kind of the whole person and the whole community. And I think that the incidence of philanthropic organizations here, which, by the way, was probably produced over time because of our business and economic success, has created those philanthropies where we're giving back to the community. And so when I look at the cycle of regional success, it starts with regional assets. And if we have a system in place, a social, economic, and sustainability system in place, where what we focus on is continually improving our assets, human assets, physical assets, social and cultural assets, and economic assets. And that's the kind of regions that are successful. And but there's a cycle, and we can't break that cycle. The cycle is about when people come here that we welcome them and we want to bring them back. Because if we bring them back, they do trade here. They sell and buy here. Then they make investments here. They hire people here. Then they become wealthy here. They make money here. And then they plow that money back, whether it's public dollars through taxes or whether it's private dollars through philanthropy, to improve our regional assets, to improve our airports, our museums, our parks, and our roads and our bridges. And if we can do that together, public-private institutional leaders, then we'll have a successful economy for a long, long time.
So we probably need to thank you very much.
Thank you.
Really appreciate the testimony. Brad, do you want to come? I think you want to come down. Thank you, and welcome. Good to see you.
Mr. Speaker, members, I have to tell you, first of all, Brad Finstead with the Center for Rural Policy and Development, and I have to tell you, walking in here, I had hesitation because I have these memories of being locked in this room for hours upon hours upon hours with a lot of you here on Health and Human Service Committee. So, but I'm glad to be back here and really honored that that you asked the Center to come and present. So what I'm going to do is... as a recovering politician, might be a little tough for me, but we each year at the center put together a state of rural Minnesota report. This last year it was about 60 some slides. So in honor of your time and respect of your time, I've tried to bring that down to about 20 slides. So I will go over that, and then I would stand for questions. So here we go. Just a real quick introduction for those of you that might not be familiar yet with the center, but the center was established in 1997 through a partnership with the state of Minnesota and the major foundations of the state, McKnight, Blandin, and Bremer. And it was really a rural legislative initiative to try to create an agency or an organization that could really look through the lens of rural Minnesota as policy issues developed. We felt at the time, with the growth of the Twin Cities metro area and the different organizations that were kind of keeping an eye out for the metro area, there wasn't one organization looking from a statewide rural perspective. So the center was created. I'm sure some of you in this room probably had your names on the bill, so we appreciate that. We're a nonpartisan, unbiased organization, 501c3, and we like to tell people that we do research, and what it is what it is. If you like it or don't, it's that's on your shoulders, not ours. So as we go through this presentation, I just want to point out this first slide that defines or shows you how we look at regions, or we call them rural plexes. We had the two Toms a few years ago, Stimson and Gillespie, put together a rural plex type plan for us. So as we started looking at data more regionally, how we were able to look at that data and what really tied communities together with like data sets. So a couple slides down here into the presentation, we'll reference back to these plexes, so I wanted you to be aware of this. So we're going to get into some demographic data, which hopefully helps paint the picture of who we are and what we are in rural Minnesota, and then we'll finish it up with some numbers in regards to employment and earnings. So population change from 1990 to 2010. What you'll see here, and I like to really just try to simplify this, the darker shaded area is the areas of the state that experienced growth, and the grayer or dark gray are the areas that saw quite a bit of a substantial amount of population decrease over the last years. You'll notice that southern tier of counties all the way to southwest Minnesota and then up the western border has had a trend of population loss. Then taking that one step further, then we look at the projected numbers for population change projected out by 2035. And you'll see that trend continues in roughly those same areas. And I would just point out here that you start adding some of those north central counties to the mix also. So it is a definite rural phenomenon, but however, In our research, we like to point out that from a rural perspective, we can't always take an us versus them approach. So we always include the metro area in our research to really try to look at where we have similarities and differences. And here you can see Hennepin County is showing up the same color or the same projected percentages as some of the rural communities. Median age. This is the lighter the shaded box or the shaded the county, the younger median age you have. So you'll see that really we call it kind of that Rochester area all the way up through St. Cloud. You have that corridor of a younger population. And then in that same, you know, southern tier, western tier, northern area, you see that a higher average median age. Population 65 plus from 2010. Again, you will see the rural trend that we have going on here. You have, again, from that Rochester up to St. Cloud, you have a more younger less of a population of the total population of 65 plus residents. You know, I know you're all very intelligent, and you get this data. But we like to point out, I mean, there's a rhyme and a reason for why we're putting out this out there. I mean, so if you, again, maybe this goes back to my days on HHS. But as you start talking about long-term care, nursing homes, assisted living, just healthcare in general, this data really matters because you'll see we have an aging population. Some counties have over 25% of their current population over 65. So when do we know they're going to be 75? Well, we know it's in 10 years. When do we know they're 85? Well, it's in 20 years. So as the legislature plans and looks at policy, we feel this is important to have on your radar screen. Natural rate of increase, pretty much birth versus death. The whiter or lighter shade counties are those that are dying more than they're having newborns. I have to point out Brown County. We're right on the verge, but I'm doing my part. I have 7 children under the age of 10, so you take me out of the equation, that county might switch into the white area. So, and Representative, I have twins, just had twins about 2 months ago. So if I fall asleep during this presentation, I'm sorry. but you'll see here, though, this is an issue of planning again. You know, you can only sustain so long if you're dying more than you're having born into your areas. So we have to look at the big picture of, well, what's next? How do we keep growing in rural Minnesota if we know this is the current trend? What do we do? What policies can we help work on that takes a look at that in a different light? Population and poverty. The darker the shaded counties, the higher rate of poverty in those counties. Again, this is one, it's a little bit more spread, but I will say, you know, pointing out, obviously, the northern half of Minnesota, you see it becomes a little bit more prevalent. You see also the Hennepin County, Ramsey County connections there. So again, I like to tell people that from a rural perspective, the more we have in common with the metro, the more we need to talk about it and work on those issues together to try to tackle some of those challenges. We'll slide into the economics, and I'm racing through this, so I apologize. But I will tell you all of this is on our website, and it's in quite a bit more detail than I'm offering. But regional per capita earned income. So if you go back to that third slide that defines the metroplexes, you'll see how this plays out. But a couple things I want to point out here. You know, you have the metroplex, a per capita earnings of $57,000, and you look at some of these rural plexes, you know, Central Lakes at 33,000, up north at 41,000, the state of Minnesota as a whole 52,000. So you have some parts of this state that are roughly $20,000+ less, and that is something that needs to be on all of our radar screen. We're going to slide in a couple of major sectors of employment opportunities in rural Minnesota. Manufacturing, we want to highlight. We have quite a bit of manufacturing jobs in rural Minnesota. In some regions, we are over 1 out of 5 employees that are employed in manufacturing. Globally, that's very high. A lot of economists will tell you 1 out of 10 is a little, you know, more average, more sustainable. We, you know, to use a farm term, we have a lot of eggs in one basket with manufacturing, so it's very important to the success of rural Minnesota. And you can see the earnings and how that plays out. You'll see that some of the rural and maybe even deeper rural communities have quite a bit lower average earning per manufacturing job than some of the same type skills, same type jobs in the metro area. And we like to point that out because we talk a lot in rural Minnesota about some of our greatest assets are our kids and our schools, but yet we have this rural approach of, you know, send them to the cities. You can get a good education and a good job. We're not so good at saying, and when you're there, come back afterwards. We just say go. And this map highlights, you know, you go towards the opportunity. So if you have that certain manufacturing skill set, and you can make, you know, $45,000 a year in Nicollet County, if you move an hour and a half away to the suburbs and you can make $65, $75 for that exact same job, then really the difference is quality of life and cost of living. And, you know, that's the constant battle and discussion we in rural Minnesota are in. This highlights the workforce number in manufacturing. You can see we have some counties that are a large percentage of their population are in tied up in manufacturing jobs. We'll go to average earnings in farming. You know, when you think rural Minnesota, you think manufacturing, you think agriculture, you think healthcare. So we wanted to just quickly highlight a couple of these areas. I like to point out here, with agriculture, with farming, you see quite a bit of leveling off of income all throughout rural Minnesota. You know, you have that pretty much bottom quarter of the state, western half going up, and it's a little bit more evenly distributed. And I, again, highlight the importance of that sector on rural Minnesota's growth and strength. Workforce in farming, you'll see that.
You know, I'm sorry, yep. So it was 1 in 5 in manufacturing. Do you know what the comparable would be for farming?
We're there right now.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Sorry.
No, that's
good.
Oh,
there you go.
I anticipated your question when
Thank
I put this
you.
Together. So we... you can see here the darker the counties, the larger of percentage of population are tied in agriculture, farming jobs. What we're seeing in farming, it's a unique world because it's such a strength and backbone of the state, but yet technology and genetics have advanced so greatly in the last 20 years. I mean, let's be honest, we have tractors that drive themselves. Part of the reason I don't want to farm anymore. I mean, that was my goal, is to drive tractor for a living, and now that they drive themselves, I don't even want to farm anymore. But it does highlight the future. You know, when technology converges with agriculture, you know, are jobs eliminated? Are there less opportunities for people to be involved? Again, I love my job because we get to raise a lot of questions. We don't necessarily have to answer them all. We leave that up to you all. Average earnings in the government sector. I felt it was important to point this out because, as you can see here, there is an opportunity for rural Minnesota to play on the same level playing field when it comes to earning opportunities. If you're tied up in the government sector, if you have an employment opportunity within the government sector. One of the reasons I pointed that out, you know, policy-wise, anything you all can do as you work through your committees and through the process to decentralize government jobs. You know, not everything has to be done in St. Paul and Minneapolis when it comes to some of these jobs. So we would just say, you know, with the advancements and the work that we've been doing with technology, broadband, and so forth, this is an opportunity for us to level that wage-earning playing field. Then we have the workforce and government sector. So you'll see some of these communities, some of these counties, again, have a large portion of their population employed by that government sector. Just wanted to point out this. Again, you know, just we could, I could have put a lot more slides here, but I wanted to give you a picture of the total school enrollment, how that plays out as far as, again, we like to layer our research. So you start taking the different maps that I've just quickly run by you, and hopefully we can start painting that picture of how one overlays on the next. So how that aging population map goes to that manufacturing workforce map, which then ties into the whole, you know, who's our pipeline for our next workers? What's the school enrollment look like? How many students do we have in the pipeline, and what does that education look like to get them into those workforce opportunities? I mean, you could see we have 90%+ of our, it's more than that, 95% of our schools are some of the smallest school districts by number in the state. And with that, of course, poses all kinds of different challenges in regards to workforce readiness and workforce development and different opportunities that our schools can do to hopefully feed that workforce pipeline. So I was asked to lay out a couple different thoughts in closing and areas of opportunities. Again, I want to highlight the, you know, based on the facts that we've just laid out, manufacturing is key to rural Minnesota. You all know that. Recent trends have shown that we have projected opportunities of great growth. A lot of different, I guess, philosophies of why that might happen. Western Minnesota has seen a strong surge of manufacturing opportunities. Some say it's tied, some, you know, is tied to the North Dakota oil boom. So I would just recommend keeping an eye on that, because you have that Western, and again, if I were to go back in the slides, you look at that population data and the age of folks over 65, but yet we have manufacturing growth opportunities in the next 20 years in that area. And that is, you know, keeping your mind on more of the global issues of competitiveness and the opportunities for market growth. Agriculture, again, the data speaks for itself. It's been a strong backbone of the state. I would say keeping a strong eye on this, especially with the next point of technology, and then ultimately that fourth point of the convergence of those. I guess you could even say the manufacturing, ag, and technology is creating a lot of opportunities where those sectors converge. So we're seeing a lot of, you know, down, you know, back to that simple point of, we're seeing tractors that can drive themselves. Do we have companies in the state that are working on that technology, developing that technology, putting that technology into the marketplace? We have such a strong cluster of ag-focused companies, so the more we can do to work on those converging opportunities. A couple points I want to make as far as keeping an eye on. Keep an eye on the workforce development. You know, if we look at, you know, one out of five employees tied up in the manufacturing world, what are we doing to tie into that third bullet point I have here? Education. You know, are we working with MinSCU, the U of M, even our high schools, to really integrate those opportunities in rural Minnesota, meeting the needs of employment opportunities, having a more responsive education system that's able to keep up with the speed of business, not the speed of a degree or not the speed of a diploma? I hear that quite often as I'm out and about talking to business owners in rural Minnesota, that they need a little bit more responsiveness when it comes to that. The last point, we did a series of focus groups. A lot of our research we take out across the state with focus groups. And over the last couple of years, I've been hearing this more and more, the need for a one-stop shop. And I was driving up today, I couldn't help but think, and it's ironic that Representative Davids is in this committee, that if I had a dollar for every time I heard all of you talk about a tool in the toolbox. And this made me think of it a little differently, that, you know, maybe we focus so much on the tool in the toolbox, we don't focus enough on the toolbox. And from a rural perspective, what we've heard over and over again in the last couple of years, that when we seek to work through different challenges, different growth opportunities, when we interface with government, it feels fractured. It feels, you know, if you have an ag issue, you go over here. If there's a deed issue, you go over here. If there's a the one-stop shop is what we've heard quite a bit about when we've been out talking to folks, that, you know, maybe there is a rethinking of how we look at economic development in rural Minnesota. Maybe there is a retooling of a Department of Agricultural and Rural Affairs, thinking about that next step of how we meet the needs of rural Minnesota. So that would be my 2 cents worth of advice, and I probably owe you money for it. So, but I appreciate being back here, and I appreciate your service. I just look at all of you and respect all of you for the time that you put in here, and respect your families for letting you do this, and I just thank you for being here.
Thanks for being here. Representative Carlson, he looks like he has a question.
Yeah, I maybe have a couple. By the way, your introductory comments about being trapped in the room, there used to be doors where these bookcases are, but somebody decided to fill those in. That dates me a bit, going back that far. But I did have a couple of questions relative to population and then your areas of opportunity. You mentioned agriculture, and I think we all recognize how important agriculture is to the state of Minnesota. But your comment about the tractor, and then I was thinking about some of my relatives that happened to be in agriculture, and where they had one farm, the way we talk about it now, they've got two and three farms, and how that's driving some of the issues that you're referring to, you know, your school enrollment, and what have you. And then my second question, you can take them both at the same time. When you talked about the number of government employees in Greater Minnesota, when I look at the map, it appears some of the concentrations are where we happen to have an institution of higher education.
Yep.
Are you counting them as government employees?
Yep.
Okay. Maybe if you could comment on the first one then with agriculture and what's happening with more and more agriculture being done with fewer and fewer people.
Sure. Yeah, it's the ultimate double-edged sword of efficiencies, being more conservation-minded when it comes to practices, tillage, farming, equipment, being able to do more with less. But ultimately, you think, you know, just the evolution of ag in the last 30 years, you know, from a two-bottom plow and a cabless tractor that would take days to get your field work done to $275,000 tractors with $150,000 discs, rippers behind them that are able to just do that much more. And you know, it's just the basic economics of you have that much money tied up. I mean, that's the thing that the story I don't think that gets told well enough is the dollars invested in agriculture in this state. Equipment alone, land, inputs. So it ag is a much different world. You know, there's a lot of internal, within the ag industry, discussions. And if we're at a turning point with how we look at farming, you know, to your point, back in the day, the common story was one farm family and 200 acres, and they made a living, and they had six kids, and they all helped, and life was great. But equipment got bigger, more expensive. They needed more land to pay for that equipment, and so on and so forth. So we've heard a lot more of talk of ag business jobs, ag opportunities. So maybe you're not the one that owns the farm, but you're definitely a part of that farm. You are trained in variable rate planting technology, where you're able to go out and computer program the farmer's planter to plant or spread fertilizer based on environmental concerns. So there's a lot of these high-tech, I guess, secondary opportunities in ag that I think we as a state need to keep our eyes on, because it does create opportunities or more opportunities for young people to stay in rural Minnesota. But the world in ag has definitely changed.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to take an opportunity to tell you that years ago when I was in the House, Mr. Fidstead was my seatmate. And I just wanted to take this opportunity to greet you, Brad. It's really good to see you.
Nice to see you.
Well, thank you for coming. This is really helpful. Thank you. Good to see you. All right. Feed. Welcome. Welcome.
Thank
How are you?
Good, thank you. thanks so much to the committee for having us, Mr. Speaker, members of the committee. Kim Babine, I'm Director of Government Affairs at DEED, and this is Dr. Steve Klein, who is the Director of Labor Market Information. Apologize for our mix-up with the presentation and your willingness to be flexible with the agenda. A lot of good information here today, and I know there's more on your agenda, but we were asked to speak a little bit to the current state of the economy. And before Dr. Hine goes into a lot of the specifics on current data and current indicators, I wanted to share just some preface information as to where we are in terms of the stability in our state. We are headed in the right direction and doing well and recovering from the recession, and a lot of our indicators are showing that we gained 12,000 jobs in August, which was a major milestone of officially recovering from the jobs that were lost during the recession, and our unemployment rate is currently at 5.1%. We know that there's much to be optimistic about, and we're excited to talk about things. We also know that there are challenges. There are still Minnesotans who are looking for work, and the changing workforce demographics provides opportunities and challenges. So I wanted to set the stage with talking a little bit about what you all did in the last legislative session to stabilize the state's budget, to create a stable environment where businesses can make decisions that they need, and so that they can see the economy improving, seeing the state investing in education. We've heard a lot about workforce today and how important that is, and our education system being key to that. Making reforms that save money, and also making the investments in jobs and economic development. So you all know this story better than most, that we, since 2002, with the ups and downs, the feast and famine in our state's budget, it caused a lot of issues for the state's economy, not only just in regular economic indicators that we saw, but then also just a general confidence in the state to be able to make investments where needed. Dr. Hine will get into a little bit more of the jobs numbers that we saw, but this shows a little bit about where we started in 2008 with the number of jobs lost and how we've been recovering jobs since that point. We know that there's a widening income gap, and are looking at what that means for middle-income earners. You can see that the wealthiest 1% took home nearly 20% of all income, and seeing where the burden of the Great Recession fell. So as we look at wages, as we look at continued job gains, job creation, that's something that we're cognizant of.
Mr. Chair, can I just add, if we have questions, would we ask them on the way here, or when we're done?
Yes, please, Senator Center.
Well, I just want to go back to the second slide, and in a way, I want you or somebody to make a case for the fact that games and gimmicks caused a budget roller coaster. And I would say during those years, politics aside, we had many good people on each side of the aisle working in a difficult circumstance from the standpoint of the economy of Minnesota to do the best job they can. And yes, it might have been a roller coaster, but I'm not sure it was games and gimmicks. I think there were other factors. You suggest here that it's games and gimmicks that caused this legislative, or pardon me, this budget roller coaster. I think it might be, maybe it was other things. We may have used legislative techniques, which people might call games, to try to address some of the difficult situations we were in. But I will tell you, there were people on each side of the aisle doing best job they could to try to make the system work, and in good faith, in my view. So that's just a comment. But going on maybe to your third slide, maybe the one you got here. Just a question. If the wealthiest 1% took home 20% of all the income, do you have any idea how much that 1% also then paid in taxes? to share to the common good?
Mr. Chair, Senator Senjum, I don't have the exact data on that. It's definitely something that I recognize is important to the state of the economy. The concern is that the middle portion of the economy, wage earners, are not that number is shrinking, and that those middle earners, those middle class jobs, are important to the continued growth and continued strength of all of the sectors that we've been talking about today.
And I think we'd all agree on that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman. Thank you. And I had somewhat a similar question to Senator Senjum, and I guess, is this intended to be a political document, or is this supposed to be some sort of objective information? And the reason I ask that is I'd like you to tell us what are the games and gimmicks, more specifically, that you believe caused this. Could you tell us and give us some examples of the games and gimmicks that you're pointing out?
Mr. Chair, Senator Han, excuse me, to Senator Senjum's point, I fully agree that there have been members on both sides of the aisle doing good work here at the legislature in the Capitol, and am very appreciative of your service and members of both parties. I think the issue that we're talking about is that there have been there were ways that budget gaps were filled that through budget deficits that were a result of economic conditions, and they were filled in such a way that there were there was instability and unknowns that didn't help the state of our economy.
And Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that, and all of us are familiar with the vagaries in the economic conditions and the kinds of choices that legislatures make with response to those things. But I understand in a campaign, in a political discussion, politicians use pejorative terms to talk about what their opponents are doing or not doing. I get that. And that's my question. If this is intended to be a political statement, fine, let's talk about games and gimmicks and let's get political. But if you're here to represent the people of the state and talk about facts, I just think this is out of line.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
I think that we can, I would just say a couple things. I think we can probably all agree that the choices that were made, and this is going over a period where Republicans and Democrats were in the governor's office, when Republicans and Democrats were in the legislature. And I don't think any of us are necessarily proud of some of the choices that were made throughout that period in terms of how we balance budgets. I won't even get into specifics because that'll start to go down the wrong track, and different choices could have been made. I think the point has been made in terms of the title of this slide in particular. And I think if you match the economy, the national economy, the state economy, with these budget deficits, there'd be correlation. If you just draw a little circle about when the economy was doing well and when it wasn't doing well, there'd be a correlation. I also think there's been a lot of discussion in recent years about decisions that we made either in 2013 or that Republicans made in 2012 and 2011 and their impact on what's happening to Minnesota's economy right now. I think Bill Blazer at the Chamber of Commerce, when he says probably decisions made 5 and 8 years ago that are affecting the economy right now, is probably the most accurate. So if we could kind of just, at least for this committee, set aside this idea of taking credit or not credit for where our economy is, and now we can maybe move forward talk about what's going on in terms of where our economy is right now. That would, I think, serve.
Mr. Speaker, I did take an opportunity to look forward at some of the beginning slides or the future slides here, and I think maybe based on the comments you made, maybe it would be better to just invite them back at a future meeting. This really is not designed to talk about where we're at right now. This is designed to place blame and to use words like games and gimmicks. Obviously not appropriate for a state agency to come to a legislative hearing and use words like that. And I won't even talk about what the future slides say, and I think maybe it's probably appropriate that we just move on to the rest of our agenda and invite them back at a future meeting.
I think what we're going to do is we will continue through it, and if people notice those things, but if we could stick to actually just the facts. And if there's other words in the slides, you know, that's fine. But if we stick to the facts of what's going on in our economy, I think that would be very helpful. I think it would inform. I think there is stuff that I haven't looked at the whole thing yet, so I think there is stuff that could inform.
I may want to jump in here and there then.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I've been trying to get the floor now for a while. I just want to make this brief comment. I'm going to go along, of course, with what you are suggesting, albeit I agree with Representative Dowd. This document, I have gone through it, and I have looked at the future documents, and it looks a whole lot more like a campaign lit piece than it does as a document coming out of a state agency. And I don't take the comments that Senator Senjum or Senator Hand made as a criticism of anybody sitting at this table or the legislature. I am, however, very critical of Deed in putting together a document that, you know, you now want to go through, and that's fine. But as I'm going through it, Mr. Chairman, it looks like a lit piece for a campaign, not as a piece of information by a nonpartisan state agency.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just let me.
Yes.
I'd like just to add.
We're going to talk about every slide.
There are a small number of us around this table that were here when the problem was created, and clearly, when Governor Plenty was elected governor, he inherited a huge problem. I mean, a real mess, and it was created because previous legislatures that I was a member of, that the Senator Sway was here a couple of years, Senators. Stephen, Representative Carlson, when the economy was really, really strong, we made some mistakes. And we cut taxes deeper than we should have when the economy was very, very strong. And then when the economy softened, Governor Plenty inherited a real mess after the 2001 recession settled in. And we have had a difficult time righting the ship. And so I think some extraordinary counting measures maybe is a better way to talk about what has been done over the last 10 years, that different mechanisms that have never been used before, but it was because previous legislatures prior to 2002 had put this legislature and governors elected beginning in 2002 in a very difficult situation. So there's plenty of blame to go around, but it's way before this slide indicates that, I would argue.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If I might... hearing the concerns, in no way was this meant to be a political document or to place blame. It was to show that this is where we stand and this is where we see as our...
Can we just go to the slide and start at the numbers?
Exactly. That's what I was going to move to. And so I will... I just wanted to apologize and say that that's... was not the intention. So I'll turn it over to Dr. Steve Hine, who is our nonpartisan labor market information director, and he will provide the data and statistics of where we currently stand.
Okay. Thank you very much, and thank you, the members of the committee, for allowing me to appear today. My task, the ask here, was to give you an overview of where our economy and particularly our labor market stand as of today, where we've been over the last few years, and what our successes have been over the last few years, as well as what our remaining challenges are in the coming year, certainly over the next legislative session. This is a chart I like to call Wild Thing, but this shows total non-farm employment over the last 13 years, that is from the beginning of the millennium through August. Because of the federal government partial shutdown, we have been delayed in releasing September and October. Those data will be coming out tomorrow morning, so unfortunately I haven't been able to include those in this chart, but I could assure you that the story will not change significantly with an additional 2 months' worth of data. As Kim mentioned, as of August, we did finally top February 2008's employment level for the first time since the recession started and the recovery followed. So in that sense, the economy is fully recovered. We are back to where we were when this precipitous decline and then the gradual increase that followed it has occurred. As of October, the data for the nation are out for October. The nation remains about 1.5 million, a little over 1.5 million jobs shy of where it was at its pre-recessionary peak. As of August 2, we were only one of 16 states that had been able to regain their pre-recessionary level. So there is, we've certainly passed the threshold by that measure. Now, it's certainly not the case that all sectors within our economy have managed to regain their pre-recessionary levels. This chart shows by major industrial sector the net change of each of those sectors through the recession and subsequent recovery. And you can certainly see that education and healthcare stand out as an area in which we've added, 57,200 jobs since February of 2008. Healthcare, in fact, was the only sector across our economy that did not lose jobs during the recession, that is from the peak in February of 2008 to our trough in September of 2009. In terms of losses, it probably won't be a big surprise that construction and manufacturing stick out as being the areas that have been hardest hit. We're hardest hit by the recession. In fact, both of them began to lose jobs well before the recession officially began and our economy as a whole began to decline. And we've also seen some significant losses in trade, transportation, utilities, almost all of which is concentrated in the retail trade sector. Professional business services is also an area of significant job increase on net over the recession recovery, with 11,900 more jobs now than in February of 2008, and 6,900 of those are in corporate headquarters. I mentioned that all sectors lost jobs during the recession, with the exception of healthcare. All sectors in the economy have gained jobs in the recovery, with the exception of the federal government, postal workers primarily in our state.
Representative Holbrook had a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. When you look at the breakdown of those jobs, certainly the category of government is pretty easily identified as funded through tax dollars. Can you tell us in the education and health what percentage of those jobs came from things that are generally paid for by tax dollars, some of the nursing homes, the K-12 schools? I don't know if you'd put in grants that supported higher ed or not, but I mean, I'm just curious of that that sector, what proportion of those jobs could be attributed to being supported by tax dollars versus what would be a more traditional.
That's a good question.
Private sector.
I'll note that education and healthcare in this chart by these numbers are private sector education, private education. So it does not include public schools and state universities. Neither does it include state or locally owned hospitals. It's private healthcare. So any, I guess, taxpayer support for these would be through in the form of grants rather than operational expenses covered by government revenue.
Oh, Mr. Chair, that might be true if we didn't so heavily subsidize health care. I asked for the figures in the state of Minnesota, over half of the babies born in our hospitals were born on public health care. About 5% higher than the national average, and of course we also would subsidize some of that education sector that you spoke of.
Sure. Yeah, thank you. Our data don't allow us to do that. Neither would it be able to distinguish construction jobs between those that are financed by, you know, private residential home buyers versus government subsidized or funded highway projects. So I'm afraid the data that we have doesn't allow us to make that distinction. I would recognize that in certain areas like healthcare, there is much more subsidization occurring. I think it would include many of these other sectors as well, many of which are not doing as well.
And just for clarification purposes, so in the government category, is that where you would find the public schools and the public higher ed institutions?
That's right.
Okay, thank you.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair?
Oh, sorry.
And I don't need a long answer. I'm just surprised, Mr. Hine, looking at I thought Minnesota was a high-tech state and that relied a lot on information technology, and I see that seemingly we decreased employment. That kind of surprises me. Is what I'm thinking about hidden in some other bar?
Yeah, these are net changes, not necessarily levels. But I think more to the point of your question is that the information sector here, while it does certainly include some of what you would deem IT-related occupations, it includes telecommunications, which have been hard hit nationally. It includes things like newspapers and book publishing that have also been hard hit. And a lot of the IT types of areas that you might be thinking of might be found in areas like computer systems design, which would be part of professional business services. Professional business services is an area that includes businesses that provide services to other businesses, and much of that these days is in the form of IT support services. Okay. And that's been doing very well of late. Okay.
Good. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay. In terms of unemployment, we had a 5.1% unemployment rate in August. That's now just slightly above the 4.8% rate, rather, that we had in December of 2007 when the recession officially started. So we are getting very close to where we were before the recession began in terms of this measure as well. At peak in May of 2009, we had 247,000 officially unemployed Minnesotans. That's down to 152,000 in August. And as you can see, we continue to fare relatively well compared to the nation, which had a 7.3% rate of unemployment in both August and October this year. I'm going to have more to say on unemployment here in a second. Layoffs, so measured by the number of individuals that are filing for unemployment benefits, recognizing that not all unemployed individuals or laid off individuals do file or can file for benefits, but it's a good measure of the pace of layoffs. We, in fact, over the last couple months have seen a number of new claims for unemployment benefits that is below anything we've seen since mid-2000. That's before the 2001 recession, the dot-com recession hit. Not by much, but it was comforting to see us get back down to that level. There was a tick up in October simply because there were about 2,000 claims filed by furloughed federal workers in our state. Turns out that they could not, should not have filed those in the first place, but they did so at the time anyways. The red line is the number of claims filed by individuals that indicate that their claim is due to a permanent separation from their job rather than, say, a plant shutdown to retool or something like that. And that also is getting very close to pre-recessionary levels. The other side of the employment coin, we conduct a job vacancy survey every 6 months. The last set of results is for the second quarter of 2013. And
During that quarter, we had 589 or something like that. 569, rather. That's the highest we've seen since 2001, again, just before the recession, before the last recession began. I also watch a series that is produced by the Conference Board, which is called Help Wanted Online. It scrapes job ads from electronic job boards. And very consistently over the last couple of years, Minnesota's been in the top 10, if not top 5, in terms of the number of unemployed individuals per vacancy. So one of the better states in terms of market conditions in that regard. And the Twin Cities area, until just the last couple months, was first or second in the nation by that measure. So looking at these very top-level numbers, we see that employment, unemployment, vacancies and layoffs are at or near pre-recessionary levels. But I do want to point out some underlying concerns that persist that are somewhat concealed by these top-level numbers, and those would include long-term unemployment, demographic disparities, and substantial underemployment. Long-term unemployment, if we define that as individuals that have been unemployed for 26 weeks or more, that's sort of typically the definition used. We still have 40,000 of our 146,000 or so unemployed individuals. About 28% of them are long-term unemployed. Now, that's down from 38% in late 2011, when it peaked. But it's still clearly well above the previous peak of 21% that occurred during the previous recession, following the 2001 recession. So we have seen significant improvement, a drop in the number of individuals from over 75 to about 40,000. Long-term unemployed, but it's still a relatively high number and certainly a high proportion of our total unemployment that falls into this category. Those individuals continue to face particular challenges in terms of reemployment. Improvement across subgroups within our population has been mixed. The unemployment rate for African Americans in Minnesota is still 15%. That's above the U.S. rate of 13.3% for African Americans and 3.5 times the rate for white Minnesotans. I only get the data from other states on an annual basis, so I don't have 2013 data yet. In 2012... the ratio of our black to white rate was 2.7. That was ninth worst in the nation. The year before, it was the worst in the nation at 3.8. We're back up to 3.5 now. So when other states' data come available, I'm afraid that we're going to backtrack there in terms of our relative standing across the states. You also see among the high unemployment groups here are our teenagers, 16 to 19-year-olds. I've separated them out in this chart because there's more going on here than just unemployment. In particular, among teens, labor force participation has steadily declined over the last decade and a half, really, falling to 45.6%. That's the blue line there in October. Along with their high unemployment rate, which stood at 15.3% in October, that translates into an employment population ratio, or the share of our teenagers that are actually working, of 38.5%. That's fewer than 2 in 5 of our teenagers are currently working. That compares to just over 60% at the end of the 1990s. So far fewer of our teenagers are able to experience work, both through high unemployment but also lower participation. Underemployment also persists. in the process of calculating employment numbers and unemployment numbers, it's a very black and white distinction. You are either working or you are unemployed or you're not considered to be in the labor force. Underemployment, though, manifests itself in many ways, and one of these that is most noticeable is the number of individuals that are working in part-time jobs, although they would prefer to work full-time. That's shown in the, is it purple?
Mm-hmm.
The top chunk there. I've also included there that small blue sliver is the number of what's called discouraged workers, people that are not working, want a job, but have given up looking and therefore sort of disqualify themselves from being officially unemployed by virtue of not being actively seeking work. And they're not doing so because they don't feel there are opportunities out there. And then the green is what are called other marginally attached. Those are people that also want to work but haven't looked because they have other impediments. They might be child care issues, transportation issues, health issues, that sort of thing. The point I want to make in this chart is that while the officially unemployed number has dropped by about 100,000 from its peak in mid-2009 to more recently, the number of underemployed individuals that are working part-time but want full-time work has only fallen 20,000 since it peaked in 2010. So we've seen much less improvement in that part of our underutilized labor resources than we do see in the official top-level number. Another way in which underemployment manifests itself is through people taking jobs for which they're overqualified or overeducated for. What this chart does is it breaks out the distribution across different job categories of educational attainment of the holders of those jobs. I base this on the American Community Survey data from 2011. 2012 isn't available yet, but that first bar then, the one to the farthest left, shows the educational attainment distribution across jobs that require high school or less. So there are 1,017,000, 18,000 people with a high school diploma or less working in those jobs. But if you go further up, there's also nearly 365,000 individuals that hold bachelor's degrees that are working in these jobs that require a high school degree or less. And you can go across the different categories of jobs there to see the number of individuals in each of these groupings that are over and sometimes under qualified. I'll point out, too, that 365,000 bachelor's degree holders working in jobs that require high school or less is more than the 272,000 bachelor's degree holders that hold jobs that require a bachelor's degree. You aggregate all that up, what we find is that half of our workforce are in jobs that they are overeducated for.
Mr. Speaker.
So there's a lot of untapped labor slack in our economy that's not reflected again in those top level numbers. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And just, do you have the numbers on that historically? How has that changed over time?
Yeah.
I'm curious as to whether we've seen an increase in the underemployment.
Thank you. Coming from the American Community Survey and that having only just started a few years ago, I can't go back to the early 2000s, certainly not the 1990s. I'm waiting for 2012. I have looked at 9 and 10, and there have been slight changes, but if I recall, I think 10 was slightly better, but not beyond the margin of error for the survey size. But I am hopeful that we'll be able to look at this year by year and see what kind of trend we're seeing.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And I'm interested in even like pre-recession levels. If I know it unemployment numbers themselves are low, but it still feels like the economy is lagging a bit. And I know that people are working in jobs making less money than they used to, and likely this would be an indicator that, there are people, higher numbers of people underemployed. So I'd, is there a way to find out that information?
Our University of Minnesota has a population center that just does an incredible job in providing access to the, underlying data that allows this. As far as I could tell, they only had 2009, 10, and 11. Okay. Maybe somebody that knows that system or, has sure. more knowledge about it can find 7 or 8, but I don't think it started before that, unfortunately, Thank you. And pretty much concludes my slides. Let me just review. By many measures, we have fully recovered.
Representative Davis.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay. Just real quick. Real quick here, and I was looking at your Find Your Center, your brochure on the data centers that from the department. Maybe this isn't for the gentleman.
Oh, from our website?
Yeah. Okay. And I worked very hard on that in conference committee to, with the governor to make sure that got done, and I'm very supportive of it. But just 2 points in the brochure there. We talk about Minnesota business tax ranks among the 10 lowest in the nation, and you're using 2011 numbers. Do we know, do we have anything updated there from 2013 as to where we are? That's one question. The other thought, or the other question is, additionally, Minnesota carry forward and lack of throwback encourages business startups, while the refundable research and development credit, 10%, you're talking about that. I think that was repealed.
Thank you. I'm sorry. That's not coming out of my office.
I
couldn't address that.
Maybe if the lady could.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, maybe.
Representative Davids, I'm not exactly sure what you're referring to or if it's been we just underwent a website conversion, and so some of the links may not have the most up-to-date information. It could be possible that that hasn't been updated with new information, but I would be happy to take a look at it and take it back to our communication staff and our program staff.
And thank you, Mr. Speaker. And if you could, because we're selling something that's very good here. The data center tax law is very, very good.
Right.
But we're using numbers that could be outdated because 2011 we didn't have the 2013 tax bill. And then also it says that we have a refundable research and development credit. I don't think we have that anymore. And we can follow up and talk about that. I just don't want to be selling. This is a really good program. Yep. I just don't want to be selling it incorrectly.
Thank you.
Thank you. Going back to the comment about the underemployed portion of the workforce, time after time from businesses we hear that the most important thing is educated workforce. We're seeing a growing number of companies saying they have jobs that are held open because they don't have the right people. So I'm trying to square up with your statistics around such a large portion underemployed, but why we also have large numbers of jobs being held open. Where's the disconnect, and what do we need to do to address it?
Thank you for that question. I'm glad to have the opportunity to address it. First of all, I think this is very much a manifestation of the lingering effects of the recession. As that second chart showed you, this recovery has not been uniform across all segments of the economy, across all regions of the state. As we recover and people find themselves, you know, locked in their home because of housing market conditions, you know, we've had a lot of difficulty regaining that alignment between the jobs that are opening up in areas of growth and the workers that are available to fill those positions. I think a lot of that is simply the transition that can take some time, especially when housing market conditions and other factors make people less mobile than they might otherwise be. I've I don't mean to suggest that education is not important to our economic health. It is our number one comparative advantage relative to other states and most other countries in the world. It's sort of like, you know, saying that Adrian Peterson is too healthy for the way the Vikings are playing right now. That we don't want to say that we need less education because there are parts of the economy that are not operating at maximum efficiency or full capacity. We need to correct those situations so that we can bring our comparative advantage back into full play. But we certainly need to re-employ individuals in positions that are more suitable to their educational attainment. This question, you know, has come up so many times that about 2 years ago we started doing a follow-up survey with employers that indicated that they had vacancies in areas that we most often hear as being prone to these difficulties in hiring. You know, a lot of the production occupations like welders or CNC operators, nursing areas and so on, STEM areas. And while we do find that a lot of employers perceive this to be a lack of skills, as we dig into these, we find that it's a much more nuanced problem, that there are a number of different factors that might create this kind of difficulty. Quite often, employers acknowledge that the wages that they can offer are not competitive. We found this a lot in nursing, where small clinics say, well, we can't offer the signing bonuses that a lot of the large health organizations can pay to attract experienced nurses. We find that a lot of employers do package together experience or educational requirements, often use the example of an IT specialist with personality, you know, people skills, that oftentimes, you know, it's called the purple squirrel. You know, people are looking for that purple squirrel that doesn't exist in many instances. I think, and I don't know how we might test this, but it's a new world in terms of matching job seekers to job openings when this is done electronically now, rather than, you know, typing out a resume on nice bonded paper and having an HR specialist at the other end read every last word and evaluate your application. Now we've got, you know, electronic mechanical algorithms that are matching keywords, and I know I experience that when I look at the resumes that I get from job postings within our agency. It's not a perfect system. In fact, I think it's fraught with difficulty. And one manifestation of that is that we might not be doing a good job the way we used to when, you know, individuals self-selected jobs that they wanted to apply for, given what they knew about their abilities and interests, rather than just putting their resume on a job bank and letting the electronics do it for them. So, you know, we found a lot of these different causes for these challenges. I think the data point out that it's certainly not the case that the overall level of our educational attainment is driving this difficulty. It may be that we don't need as many, you know, Renaissance sports studies majors as we might have wanted or needed at one point in time, and we might need more of another. We need to develop ways of making our educational system more responsive, primarily in terms of recognizing where growing demand is and where shrinking demand is.
Thank you.
Okay. Do you want to just... Did you want to go over your last slide, or did you cover those?
I'm sorry. Well, it really was...
The interview stuff.
I guess we did make a big thing, and I think it's worthy of making a big thing of the fact that we'd regained all those jobs we lost. There was 161,000 of them, you know, and it was a big deal to get back to where we were. And when we get back to where our unemployment situation was, that will also be a sign of significant improvement. But there are these underlying challenges, and they have been greatly exacerbated by the recession and have not been cured by the recovery so far. So I wanted to just make that point. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for coming. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
There was one slide that investments in our competitiveness that was amongst some of the slides that it's on page 3.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to get a professional's view, and probably there's never enough money, but do you know how we might stack up in terms of state investments towards competitiveness with other states? And if the answer is no, that's fine. I mean, this is probably not even a fair question.
If you're asking
any instincts or anything like that,
the relative value of these investments compared to other states?
Maybe not so much. I mean, I happen to believe that in some cases we're in a free agency market, whether it's with Texas or anyone else, Iowa, that there are job incentive-type states out there that we're competing with for bringing either growing jobs within our state or bringing jobs to our state. And we use these funds, I think, in various ways to encourage job growth and development. And the question then is, are we reasonably competitive, or are we on the low end, or are we, should we be proud of these numbers? And if you don't know the answer, that's fine. This is probably not a fair question.
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
Senator Sundrum, that's not necessarily in Dr. Hines' labor market view, but I have some information on that. We haven't completed analysis after this session, really across the nation. Legislatures completed their work, but we know going into about a year ago, going into last session, when we were making the case to really fund recapitalize the MIF fund and make an investment in a new program with Job Creation Fund, that we were one of the lowest. Texas with a $200 million fund, Michigan with 50. There, we without a dollar in MIF, we were at zero, and Job Z was sunsetting, and no Job Creation Fund. We really didn't have, we weren't at the table. And so now we are still in kind of a Minnesota tradition. We still look at these incentives in a very modest fashion. And so I don't have the new 50-state analysis as to where we were or where we are now. We were very low. Now we're in the game. Can compete along with our other factors that other testifiers talked about, what companies look for.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. One more, then we do need to move on.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. One of the things that I think we've been waiting for has been unemployment numbers from September and October, and I know there was some discussion that they were delayed because of the shutdown. I know at this point now we're, a month later, and I think most states have seen at least the September numbers out, and a lot of states have September and October out.
No, they come out tomorrow. The BLS will release them on Friday. We always release them a day earlier, along with a handful of other states. But systems have been running as late as Monday to get the necessary data to states so that they can produce this.
The U.S. came out for September.
The U.S., the national data came out for
state.
September
Not the state
and
data.
October.
So when will we see the September and October numbers?
Tomorrow morning.
All of them. Okay. And then just anecdotally, there was some stories in the last couple of days that the unemployment numbers were not accurate prior to the last election. Apparently, somehow numbers were fudged, or there's some allegations that happened. How do we know that the numbers we're seeing here in Minnesota are accurate, and what? How do we come up with those? Just refresh me on how we come up with those numbers, and how do we ensure that they're accurate?
I can assure you that they're not accurate. It's based on a survey of here in Minnesota about 1,700 households. It's just too small for me to confidently say, hey, these are accurate. They're the best we can do. And we have no opportunity to influence these ways. The way the data are collected by the Census Bureau and fed to the Bureau of Labor Statistics and ultimately to us are through electronic systems that don't even allow us to go in and, if we knew how to make changes to those survey responses.
You're familiar with what I'm talking about, though,
the story today?
It was yesterday and the day before. It was kind of breaking that apparently some census employees fudged some numbers, and that's what caused the unemployment numbers to take a kind of a historic drop right before the 2012 election. So there's some stories floating in the last couple of days that was the case. So basically, if we find that the national numbers were inaccurate, it's likely that ours are as well.
Well, they're done differently. They're both based on those individual responses that households provide to the census takers regarding their employment situation. So if the influence here is via actually changing those census takers' responses, that would impact our numbers. I would be very curious to see the explanation, and I'd be happy to give you my insight into it.
Sure. I read a little bit of the story, and it basically, and you probably know more about this than I do, but it's...
Actually, we have to get through all these things, and so we can maybe take this offline.
I wanted to just finish that thought. It just take a second. Literally, they said that census workers, apparently it was one person they contacted was good for 5,000 jobs, and that's how they came up with, or some ratio like that, and that census workers apparently didn't contact that many people, and they kind of just filled in the work, and it wasn't verified. So that's the allegation. I don't know whether it was true, but that's the story that's out there. So potentially ours could be subject to that same kind of.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. All right. So we're going to try to finish up this. The recommendations, and then at December we'll collect this and have a final vote on it, and if the public wants to weigh in, they can. But we will do a draft of the whole set of recommendations. So we met, 10 days ago, 2 weeks ago, and went through the remaining numbers. I will say that anything that was reviewed by the Sunset Commission previously, we just decided we wouldn't review this time around because it had already gone through a review. So there's a number in this this set of recommendations that fall into that category. So let's start with DHS, and it's 410, so keep that in mind as you're as we're moving through this. A number of, obviously, as you can see from the sheet of these task force and work groups and DHS. I think the first one is the Medical Assistance Drug Formulary Committee. And we're asking for further review, partly because this committee expired under law. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Sarah Drake. I am the Pharmacy Program Manager at Minnesota DHS. I've been with the department since early 2009, and every summer we follow the established process to post and fill the vacancies for our Drug Formulary Committee through the Secretary of State's open appointment process. And I'll be honest, this is the very first time I've heard that our Drug Formulary Committee has actually expired, so this comes as a bit of a surprise to me and to the rest of our pharmacy team at DHS. I will say that the Drug Formulary Committee is an integral part of our efforts to ensure that we're able to provide the best possible drug benefit for public program recipients at the best value to the taxpayer. Our Drug Formulary Committee does have a number of responsibilities that are outlined in 256B, 0.0625, and those responsibilities don't expire. For example, the statute requires that before we can place any drug on prior authorization, that drug needs to be reviewed by the Drug Formulary Committee. The formulary committee also advises us on the maintenance of our preferred drug list. The formulary committee is tasked with helping determine which over-the-counter drugs should be part of our drug benefit set. The formulary committee advises the department on which drugs should be considered specialty drugs and thus eligible for more aggressive reimbursement discounts. The formulary requires also recommends the general criteria that we use for prior authorization for new drugs on the market and drugs for which there are generic equivalents available. And just even in the last year, the legislature authorized new language requiring the Drug Formulary Committee to advise the department on the selection of preferred diabetic testing supplies. So, you know, at a high level, the Drug Formulary Committee really advises us on the purchasing of drugs and helps us make effective purchasing decisions.
You want to keep it?
Yes, we do.
Representative Newman.
Given the fact, Mr. Chairman, that DHS wants to keep it, would seem to me maybe appropriate to just the recommendation would be to send this issue back to HHS and let the correct committee make that call rather than us making it.
Okay.
That would be my thought, rather than us doing it, have HHS, which is the committee that has jurisdiction over the issue.
Okay. I mean, the only other thing, yeah, we could do is, I mean, someone's going to have to act to bring it back to life one way or the other, right?
Yeah, and
because it's expired. Okay.
Because it's expired.
Yes.
And I think that would be HHS, that committee.
Well, and just to be clear, all of these recommendations are going to have to go through the committees of their jurisdiction
sure.
to look at anything, you know, before they become law. Yes. Did you have something? Okay.
I was just going to move that we keep it, but.
Well, we can recommend that it resuscitate, but it will have to go to HHS. If that's, are you comfortable with that?
I would be more comfortable with HHS independently of this committee coming to the conclusion that they agree with DHS that it is needed. It's a very cursory explanation that we have just received, and for us to come to the conclusion, yeah, we agree. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that it would be more appropriate for HHS to handle it within their committee, given the fact that this has, in fact, expired. To me, that there's a distinction when we are dealing with a committee that has, in fact, expired because a previous legislature has set this deadline.
Okay. Well, why don't we... I think we have the information we need right now, and we can kind of, as we put together a recommendation, we'll take it from there.
All right. Thank you.
The Medical Assistance Peer Advisory Task Force. And it looks like the recommendation is supporting the repeal of this task force.
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct.
Okay. Does anybody have any questions on that one? Representative Loffitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I've heard a lot. I was so shocked a few years ago to look at the number of denials of care that were filed by the health plans and others. And it's been a while since I've looked at any of that sort of stuff. But they're really, you know, now that we're ratcheting back managed care rates, I think for some good reasons, and some other things, I think the whole issue of, you know, medical necessity will be called into question more frequently. And I'm not saying this is the best approach, but to just leave it to the discretion of the commissioner, I think creates some issues in terms of process. But I don't recall exactly how all the steps work when a patient who's enrolled in one of our healthcare programs feels that they have been denied a service that they think is critical to their health. And the steps that they go through to have that reviewed. And I'm just wondering whether this is one that at least the Health and Human Services Committee should look at, because we do need to have an appeals process that works effectively, and maybe there are other ways to do it other than this. But I do think that there's going to be more pressure on this as healthcare financing gets squeezed more.
Okay. Well, we can talk about that. I mean, again, especially if we recommend that something be repealed, that will clearly go to that mm-hmm. that committee. to talk about it. But do you want to talk about how – why don't you talk about why you think it can sunset?
Oh, thanks, Mr. Chair. My name is Julie Marquardt. I'm the Acting Director of Purchasing and Service Delivery at DHS. And I think, you know, Vicki can probably we've tried to resurrect the history of these committees, actually, because they – to our knowledge, have never existed in our time there. But to answer your question, that says a lot, I guess. To answer your question about what would happen there, it depends on if the person's in fee-for-service or managed care. In fee-for-service, there's a review process. If something is determined to be not medically necessary, there's a couple of avenues. The provider themselves can ask for reconsideration, and within the contracts of those medical review organizations, they are required to do a peer review. So somebody other than the original denier has to take a second look at that. Sometimes it's required to be a panel of persons, depending on the type of service. If it's managed care, they have a similar process that they must go through. The recipient themselves, then, in both cases, has an appeal right. And that could be heard by the managed care organization. If it's fee-for-service, it's heard at DHS by the ALJs. But at that point, we also take a second look at that, because we're asked to defend the appeal, then that comes back to the department. We take a second look. And then I would say more broadly, when we have issues where we might see a pattern of denials, we may take a look at that from a policy perspective. We may also use the Health Services Advisory Committee, which I think is really kind of getting at maybe what this originally intended, where we have a broad-based cross-section of providers. We also have subsets of that. We have a Dental Services Advisory Committee. We have right now a non-emergency medical transportation. We meet regularly with the durable medical equipment people. We meet regularly with the rehab services groups, PTOT speech as a group. We meet with pharmacy representatives, and we do a lot of ad hoc meetings when we're looking at changing policies. So I think we have lots of ways to get at this that this committee doesn't seem to serve a purpose for us because we didn't know it existed.
Mr. Chair, we have a much more extensive process, which I was suspecting we probably did, but your answer here just says let's get rid of it. It's up to the commissioner. And I think, you know, we need to say there are other mechanisms other than just the commissioner making a ruling in terms of bringing other professional input into the review. That'd be great. We're just working from the paper here. Sorry.
Mr. Chair, if I might, and maybe it might help kind of let you know how the working group approached this. We looked at if it was something that hadn't been meeting and the commissioner didn't need it and we didn't see any real big purpose for it. We went along with it fully knowing, as in the case of the last one that Senator Newman spoke about, that each of these are going to have to go to the Committee of Jurisdiction. They can certainly disagree with our recommendation, but that we approached it from more of like a 10,000-foot level and not getting into the nitty-gritty because we don't have the expertise to know how these particular ones interact or not with other active committees or processes within those various agencies. So I'm not disagreeing with you, but if the commissioner says that they don't want it, we kind of, unless we saw a burning reason why to keep it, we went along with it and figured that the fight could occur in the committee.
That's fair.
And we'll make that clear as we present the recommendations too. I mean, that's something, that's a good point to keep in mind, what the scope of what we were looking at is. So I think we perhaps want to recommend the repeal of this and then take it to the committee. Okay. So, and then the Vendor Advisory Task Force, I think also no longer need that as the recommendation. Why don't you explain a little bit about that?
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Vicki Kunerth. I'm with the Office of Inspector General, and I'm responsible for a division of fraud investigators in the Medicaid program. And both these two task forces, the one we just discussed and this next one, both deal with the commissioners seeking advice around medical necessity. What's interesting about the placement of these task forces is they're both in paragraphs that deal exclusively with our fraud investigations, and that's why it was unusual. Medical necessity is rarely, although it does happen, a fraud investigation issue, because Julie Marquardt's division has established the policies, the benefit policies, and has these other resources. On a rare instance, particularly in a criminal investigation or when we are prosecuting a Medicaid provider, the Attorney General who is prosecuting may hire a specialist or a consultant on a medical necessity issue. But on a day-by-day basis, we also may consult with the medical review contract that the department has about a particular pattern of billing or something like that. But for the most part, it is extremely rare in our fraud and abuse investigations. And but similar to the previous conversation, we have these other resources. We have advisory committees in the department already set up, so we think this one could be deleted as well.
Any other questions on that one?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is, and again, we're going off of notes here, but the notes that we have is that this task force would be, you know, called at the discretion of the commissioner. You're not currently meeting, but that you don't need the legislative authority or the statutory authority anymore, but you're recommending that we allow you to keep the statutory authority. And it sounds all very confusing to me. Either you need...
They changed their mind on that. They're recommending it now be repealed.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. So now we're going to repeal this one.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Then I got confused.
The paper is confusing.
Okay.
Because I think that we're going to... As of now, they're recommending it be repealed.
Okay. Thank you.
And so are we comfortable with that, everybody? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Services to Persons with Developmental or Physical Disabilities Task Force. And if anybody, you know, quite frankly, if anybody sees any others on this list that the task force has recommended or the small group recommended we keep and want to do something different with it, you're certainly willing to pipe up on that, too. Welcome. How are you?
Very good. It's good to be here. I'm Alex Bartolik. I'm with the Department of Human Services, and I'm the Director of Disability Services. Now, this task force that's mentioned here is not one that's currently been meeting, but actually over the past year we've been talking about we think we're missing something. We have a number of work groups or advisory groups that are around specific topics, redesigning PCA or working on quality, that include a lot of stakeholders, including a lot of professionals that can meet during the workday, and where the people who use services are often kind of a lonely voice, and they're in a way trying to keep up with figuring out the system in order to contribute. And what we're seeing a sense with all the reforms going on is a place for people who use services just to talk to us about their lives and not have to understand and be involved in task forces and advisory committees that get so deep into topics, but just to be able to say, I don't understand my notices, or when I'm service planning, what does this mean, so that we can hear more of their experience with the system and be able to use that to better inform it. This has really come to light, not only in part of all the reform going on and realizing how difficult it is for people to understand all the moving pieces, but it really came to light during our Olmstead planning. When we went around the state and listened to people talk about what they would want in the service system, and they're just plain confused, and they feel really not able to to speak very well on behalf of themselves. And I think as a system, we could do a better job if there were some forums for them to be able to work differently with us. To be honest, I don't know if this will be a task force that we will set up in the next 2 months. We're right now meeting with different citizen groups and different groups of self-advocates and people who use services to find out from them, what is the best way for us to meet with you? Is it forums? Is it surveys? Is it an advisory committee process? But we'd like the statutory authority because it does give us the ability to be able to go forward and move forward if an advisory committee or task force is the best way to approach this.
Any discussion on that?
Just a question.
Yeah.
I don't have any quarrel with this at all. I have a resident back in Rochester that has applied for the Council of Disabilities, and would there be overlapping functions here?
I think that's a good question. No, there really isn't an overlap. We try to work together with the different councils. They have different types of planning and visioning and different focuses. What we're looking at is really about how the Department of Human Services and the services they receive from us, does it make a difference in their lives?
Okay.
Does it work the way it should work, and what should we be doing differently?
Sounds like a good council. Works.
Except that it hasn't been doing anything.
Right.
I'm going to suggest this. I mean, it sounds from the testimony that you would like to retain the authority because you want to do this in the future. So maybe we can recommend that we repeal this. It's going to have to go to the committee. And in 2 months, if you've gotten this work together, you can go to the committee and make the case. In fact, you are using it. And we'll make clear in our recommendation that the reason for that is because it hasn't been used and it's kind of open.
Over. And I'd like to add to that, I'm sure that there might be an ability, if you do want to go forward with this or similar thing, to set the language to reflect your new model rather than just using what's on the books. You may want to tweak it or whatever. So I'd say get busy in the next 2 to 3 months and make your case to the committee.
Are people comfortable with that? Okay. Thank you. Okay. Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities. And this one, so this is tricky. I think it's here because it's kind of tricky language because the statute creates the ombudsperson. And then within the statute, there's this language creating this medical review subcommittee, and that's what I think we're particularly interested in. Well,
thank you, Mr.
Is that right? I think that's what we... Well, you can go ahead with that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm going to try and be as brief as possible in deference to your time. We do have a 15-member advisory committee that is authorized with 5 members being appointed to serve on the medical review subcommittee. We couldn't do our job without that advisory committee, so the simple answer is we would really like to keep it. The average cost of running that advisory committee has been about $400 a year. We budget $1,500. None of our members they don't seek any reimbursements. They don't get a per diem. And we have forensic pathologists from the Hennepin County Medical Examiner's Office. We have doctors. We're hoping to get a nurse in our next round of appointments. And the only way to have credibility is to have professionals reviewing the work that our medical review unit does, and I think that it's critical.
Please go ahead.
The rest of the advisory committee is important to us because it keeps us in touch with the real world.
Okay, and I think the reason we asked for further review is because we didn't have the information that you just presented or the information that's in the packet when we took this one up, so we just didn't know one way or the other. So are people comfortable just keeping this one?
Figure it out. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry to drag you down.
That's quite all right.
Okay. Department of Health, the Health Care Reform Review Council. Boy, it's lots of old friends today. Okay. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, Dave Greenman with the Department of Health. And I have Diane Rydrick with me, who is the director of our health policy division at the department. Do you want to go ahead?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure, Mr. Chair and members. As Dave said, I'm Diane Rydrick. I direct the health policy division for MDH, and I'm here to speak to the Healthcare Reform Review Council. This is an advisory body that was established in 2008 as part of the state health reform activities. It met several times between 2008 and 2010. Members received updates on federal health reform implementation in those early stages, as well as on our statewide quality reporting, provider peer grouping, and healthcare homes initiatives. After 2010, the activities were really superseded when the Governor's Health Reform Task Force was established, and we went on to establish other advisory bodies that would give us more specific guidance on those individual programs. So we have a number of advisory bodies that give us direct and very useful input on each of those health reform initiatives under 62U and 256B. So the group has not met since the end of 2010, and we are recommending that it be allowed to sunset.
Okay. Any discussion on that one? Okay. Do you want to go to the? Are you peer grouping too?
Mm-hmm.
Are you everything?
I'm not everything.
Okay. Why don't we do?
I'm kind of everything.
You're everything. Okay. Well, why don't we go to peer grouping, because it kind of falls within the mm-hmm. same. That's maybe one of the examples of those mm-hmm. smaller groups that you talked mm-hmm. about. Okay.
Sure, Mr. Chair.
So you guys can find it on your sheet. There. Mm-hmm. It's on the next page.
Yes, this is the Provider Peer Grouping Advisory Committee. This is a group that advises the department on a variety of issues related to developing and modifying and implementing the methodology that underlies our provider peer grouping program. The group has met three times in 2012, has met twice so far this year, and we're madly searching for a date when about 20 people with busy schedules can get together between now and the end of the year. It has been providing very, very useful input to us since it was first convened. It's a broad group that includes providers, payers.
Can you tell us what peer grouping mm-hmm. is?
Certainly, Mr. Chair and members. The Provider Peer Grouping Initiative is part of, again, the 2008 health reform law. It's a process through which the department is working to develop an assessment of value of hospitals and clinics in the state, looking at cost and quality and patient experience that's provided in those organizations, and then publicly releasing that information so that providers and consumers and payers can have more transparency about quality and value in the state. The advisory committee includes a really broad range of stakeholders. It includes providers, payers, quality improvement organizations. There are researchers and academics on that group. There are consumers on that group. There are employers on that group. We're trying to really represent the full range of groups that we think have expertise in this, and they've been providing us very useful information that has helped to shape the methodology and has led to some significant modifications in the methodology based on their input over the last year and a half.
Are we going to get it done?
Mr.
And secondly, I think another question was, with federal health care reform, is this still... Now, this is part of the 08 Minnesota reform. Is this still important?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, yes, we are going to get it done, and I would argue that it's even more important probably in light of federal health reform activities. The legislature in 2008 was really forward-thinking in setting out these reforms, as you know, many of which laid the groundwork for federal reform, but in some ways went further in really making an effort around transparency and thinking about value in health care before that was really even on the radar, I would say, federally. There are not many states that are doing work like this. And it is really groundbreaking work. So we think it's as important, if not more important now, than it was several years ago.
Representative.
Mr. Chairman, what, if any, out-of-pocket expenses or per diems are paid to the folks that are involved in this group?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative, we do not pay any per diems or expenses for this group, and there was not a specific allocation for this group. So we fund its expenses such as they are, just for meetings, out of our programmatic budget.
So can we keep this one?
Of course.
Okay. All right.
Based on the last answer, yes.
All right. So repeal and keep. Then any others that fall within, or you're done? Okay, thank you.
Do you want to talk about the lab review?
Sure.
The environment? Okay. Joanne Bartkus, who's the director of our public health lab, is coming up. And one thing I wanted to mention in terms of a little bit of background on this particular advisory committee, The department is charged with accrediting environmental labs in the state, and part of the accreditation process is an assessment of the lab. Previously, the department had been doing the assessments in-house. In 2013, legislation was passed to direct the department to instead contract with other entities to identify approved entities to actually do the assessments themselves instead of having the would be outside groups doing the assessments. And this advisory committee was formed for the purpose of reviewing the applicants to be the assessors and making recommendations to the commissioner.
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you. I am Joanne Bartkus. I'm the director of the Public Health Laboratory, and Dave pretty much covered the background. We actually reduced our fees and enabled the labs to contract with third-party assessors, but we retain the ability to approve those assessors to make sure that they are actually qualified to do those assessments. So this committee was put into statute to help us choose these assessors and to actually, because it's a very, very new process, to allow the laboratories to participate in this process. So there's representatives from commercial labs, municipal laboratories, industry laboratories, non-governmental client, a variety of different participants. We have gone through the first round of RFPs for proposals for assessors. The committee has selected 11 individuals and two organizational assessors. We think that most of the activity is going to be in the first couple of years because this is a new process. I think the question is, why doesn't this sunset? Is this ongoing? I think we will continue to have new applicants for the assessors. The amount of activity might drop off, so we don't think it would be unreasonable to sunset this in, say, 5 years, 2018, something like that. There is an ongoing component, but again, we maybe could handle that in a different way if necessary.
I don't know, Mike.
Mr. Chairman, are there specific criteria the applicants have to meet, and if they meet it, then they are qualified, or is this system being applied in a more subjective manner?
Mr. Chair and Senator, this is, it's both, actually. It's there are criteria, and the review panel actually review the applications to make sure that the assessor qualifications are met. So, there are defined criteria, but sometimes the interpretation of the criteria can be somewhat subjective. So it's a little bit of each. It's kind of like reviewing college applications, I guess. Maybe not that subjective.
I honestly can't remember why this is on the list.
Is it because of the death? There's no expiration date?
That was because of no expiration date.
Yeah.
Okay. So you'd suggest maybe a 2018 expiration date?
We could do that, or
so moved.
Okay.
Yeah, that's fine.
All right. Thank you.
Moving along now.
Yeah. Let's see. Which one do you want to go with?
How about the Health Licensing Advisory Council?
Okay.
Colleen Paulus, who manages that, the area that oversees this, is coming down. This is a law that actually gives the commissioner authority to appoint an advisory council to advise the commissioner on matters relating to the registration or regulation of providers. Most provider groups have a board that does this, or have boards established in statute. This would be something the commissioner would have the authority to do, to set up an advisory council for those that don't have, currently have. These are usually newer occupations in some cases.
Okay. All right, welcome. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Colleen Paulus, manager of the Food, Pools, and Lodging Services at the Minnesota Department of Health. And the advisory group that we have is for the environmental health specialist sanitarian. And these are the individuals that inspect restaurants, swimming pools, lodging, resorts throughout the state. And the advisory group is made up of both city, county, state, private business, and members at large, consumers. And so it's a really good opportunity for us to get some input in terms of the recommendations. What the committee does is they review transcripts so that we have qualified candidates that can sit for the exam every year. And there's an exam in the spring and an exam in the fall. So the committee meets about twice a year to review all the transcripts. In addition to that, they will make recommendations in terms, the advisory group will make recommendations to the department if there's any changes that need to be made. And they did so, and right now we are in the process of seeking a rule change for the requirements. In addition to that, there's a part of the rule where the advisory committee can make recommendations to the commissioner if there's any complaints in regards to a registered environmental health specialist. So we find value in this group. There, in terms of costs to the department, it's about $2,000. They receive a per diem. They have some travel expenditures. And then we do offset that with some revenue. We receive about $7,100 a year to cover the cost of this program.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I'm lost. I thought we were on the Health Licensing Advisory Council, so I'm not sure what we're talking about here.
I think the statutory authority is general, and the commissioner has actually used that authority to create what you're talking about.
Yes.
And Mr. Chair, I think what Ms. Paulus is talking about is one function in which that committee actually played was working with this particular group of providers to advise the commissioner.
So essentially, so we have the boards of health, board of nursing, we have professional boards set up, and then for other professions that come up, the commissioner can convene for a period of time or longer this advisory council for professions that aren't covered by statutory ones. That's the gist of this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you're talking about one where the statutes don't have a board that would cover that occupation.
Yes.
But if I might, so does by virtue of having this, does this allow the Commissioner of Health to determine who has to be licensed or not? So in other words, if the sanitary workers or whatever, sounds like they're getting licensed now, but it never came through the legislature. Is that correct?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm not sure I understand your question.
So the people that you're talking about, did we in the legislature pass a law that said those folks should be licensed, or is the commissioner deciding on his own authority that certain groups should be licensed or not? I think that's the gist of the question.
Mr. Chair, I think as I read the statute, it appears that the statute is 214.13, and it directs the commissioner to make recommendations to the legislature about regulating various types of providers.
Okay.
Representative Carlson. Mr. Chairman, I think the history on that particular question goes back a long way. And we had a proliferation of groups that were coming forward for licensure. And there were decisions made. We passed a number of years an act that was known as the Health Care Credentialing Act. And I think that was later modified so that they were empowered to make recommendations if a group would be licensed. If they didn't need a full licensure, then they were either credentialed or, I forget the term that you just used.
Mr. Chair, okay. Committee members, it's registration.
Registration, yes. Whether they should be registered, credentialed, or a recommendation made to the legislature for licensure, which is the higher level, and I think it was to reduce, quite frankly, legislative workload and involvement in creating a proliferation of licensing boards.
Right, Madam Chair. The statute gives us the authority to require some registration, but it doesn't give us the authority to regulate the providers. That we would need legislative approval to do.
Yeah. So then you'd come, Madam Chair, here,
Representative Carlson,
higher level of licensing or credentialing. Okay.
I'm sorry.
Representative Holberg.
Madam Chair, maybe it needs to be renamed then to the Health Registering Advisory Council.
And so we should make that recommendation?
Well, no, I'm tired. I'm
and showing so many the humor.
Mr. Madam Chair, so many of these things looking at them make no sense. I mean, so, but we're not going to fix the world today either, so.
And so, Representative Holberg, do you have a recommendation?
Well, Madam Chair, the working group recommended repeal, but if the department, it sounds like they saved the committee time and headaches by giving advice and some of the other things that don't rise to a level of licensure, taking care of them administratively. So, I mean, I guess with that additional information, I'm kind of agnostic.
Why don't we keep? All right.
Okay. Yeah, that's what we're.
All right. Yeah, and we could send it to the committee to take a look at, without recommendation, maybe. How about that? All right. So, thank you very much. Do you want to do the water?
The water supply system to the wastewater treatment facilities. Advisory Council, yes.
Yes.
Bob Smood, who works in this in our environmental health area, is going to talk about that. We also have Kirk Kadelka from the MPCA here to.
And I think the reason this is here is because it expired in 2009. At least we think so. So let me just ask this: is do we need this to get EPA funding?
Yes, we do. We could lose up to $730,000 if we don't have. A stakeholder council.
Well, I don't know. What is that used? What is that money for?
We received the money through our drinking water revolving fund program, and it's called set aside money, and it's used to operate or to run our program.
So your program is fully federal funded.
It is at least 50% federally funded. The rest is fees.
The rest is what?
It's fee money from municipalities.
Okay. So there's no state general fund money going on?
No, there's not.
And, Mr. Chair, I don't know if we were just lacking information on this. I know.
We said repeal, so I don't remember either.
Remember so have you been meeting?
Yes, we meet at least once a year.
All right. Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, I guess we have to keep it if we need it for money, but I'm hoping that, I mean, it just seems like we got a lot of water committees, and they're in ag, they're in environment, they're in.
That's what the.
So.
Hold on one sec. Okay. So it expired. We didn't know at the time we met that it was needed for EPA funding. That information wasn't with us. So I'm going to recommend that we keep it, but that, I mean, to your point about, well, that's actually a much bigger issue about the intersection of water in multiple agencies that I don't know we want to tackle at 10 to 5 today. Thank you for coming.
All right.
And good to see you, Dave.
Thanks.
Yes. And we have one more, I think, right? The Arts Board Advisory Committee. And I will say, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think the question one of the questions we have here is that we have 33 different advisory committees. So if you want to address that one.
Sure, Mr. Speaker, members of the committee. I'm Sue Jens. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Arts Board. I was actually asked to respond to 10 questions. I won't.
Sure,
I'll touch lightly on just a couple of those.
Okay.
I thought it would be helpful just to give you a very brief overview of how we use advisory committees and why we have 33. I think that was the question. Our board is 11 members. They're represented, or they're appointed by the governor, approved by the Senate to represent the state of Minnesota. And grant making is our principal activity. We are charged in statute to receive requests for grants, loans, and other assistance. And we use advisory committees to help us decide which of those grant proposals to fund. Grant making is our central activity, and we really don't think we could do that without those advisory committees. The committees are not ongoing. They don't meet indefinitely. They each have a specific task, and once that task is completed, that particular committee ceases to exist. The number of committees varies based on the number of applications, and right now we're receiving about 1,300 applications per year. So that has a lot to do with the numbers. They serve really a peer review function. Those committees come together, and they are very carefully constructed to represent the various artistic disciplines or genres that are being reviewed. There are individuals who have expertise in managing nonprofits or in projects or have other kinds of skills that are related to the grant programs that they're reviewing. They're each given 25 to 35 applications to review. They do that work on their own at home, but then they come together and they meet in two-day public meetings, and they discuss each of the proposals in a public meeting, much like this, and give feedback on the proposals. And then based on the scores that they assign, a ranked list is given to our board for the board to approve. And then again, once that two-day meeting is finished, that particular committee ceases to exist. They don't continue to meet. They don't have budgetary authority, and in fact, the agency pays for the costs related to those committees. They are not paid for their time. They're serving as volunteers. We do reimburse them for mileage and for travel and meals at state-approved rates. Our total appropriation in fiscal 2013 was $30,820,000. That's combined general fund and arts and cultural heritage fund dollars. The cost of our advisory committees in fiscal 13 was just over $61,000. So 0.2% of the total appropriation is being spent on those advisory committees. We think that's an efficient use of resources, but the real benefit is the public input. We have about 11,000 hours of public input when you think about all of their time added together. We also strive for demographic and geographic representation on those committees so that we are really trying to reflect the priorities and the interests of Minnesota. Each of the committees is about 7 to 10 members. And so as we think about what might we do differently or what might we do in another way, we could perhaps bring it all in and have it be staff-driven. We don't think that would be as rich a process because it doesn't involve the expertise and the opinions and the views of our stakeholders. It also wouldn't necessarily save money because of the workload. We expect that we would need to have some additional staffing. As far as whether we need to continue having those committees, we really do believe it's important to the richness of the work that we do. We think that anybody who comes to those public meetings sees a rigorous process, they see a thoughtful process, they see that's one that's informed by people who know the business and know the priorities of the state. So we would hope that this committee would recommend that we continue to have the authority to appoint committees. The statute says that our board has the ability to determine which committees are essential to the performance of its responsibilities. We think that we have done that relatively well and hope that you will agree and would continue to allow us to do that.
Our Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there anything in the statutes concerning the Art Board Advisory Committee that would require the board to come back at any time in the future and provide status reports to the legislature or updates or anything of that nature, or is this something that just goes on ad infinitum?
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, the statute says that we have the authority to appoint advisory committees for a term of up to 4 years, and we actually don't. We don't allow anyone to serve more than 3 years on a particular committee, and that's indefinite. There is no sunset on that. We are required every year to provide a report to the legislature and to the governor on which individuals have served on those committees, where they live, and which conflicts of interest they have declared. So you do get an update from us on how many individuals and where they're from and which committees they've served on.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think, you know, it's amazing that you get this many people to volunteer and do it. Now that we have so much money going into the arts, I really do think we need to kind of look at whether or not we can grow these committees sufficiently to really deal with the volume of work and do it in a fair and an equitable way. I've heard, you know, I represent a high arts district area, and I've had people who say they think it's the best thing under the sun, and I've heard from others who feel like the person who was assigned to review them did not have the appropriate background, did not take the time to understand their application, and who felt like that there's starting to be rumblings, I will just say low rumblings, but about whether or not this really is as fair and open a process as we'd like. And I think just the amount of wonderful investment that the voters have made into this area makes it an area that we're, I think we're just going to have to keep working with you on. But we definitely do want some outside input beyond the State Arts Board to help figure these things out. But so thank you for managing it, what you have. But let us know if you need some reinforcement.
Okay. Any further discussion? Why don't we, I would suggest we keep this authority for them to allow them to do this. I think part of the question in the small group, though, was that these are focused on particular arts areas, and does it become incestuous? Right, I mean, that was, you know, so you're recommending, to Diane's point, you know, are people recommending their friends for money? And that's not an issue that's kind of within the purview of this committee necessarily, but I think it is a, it's kind of what was on our mind as we were looking at this.
Well, and I think just for, I'll just put my two cents worth, and I mean, I understand having separate committees for all these different types of art categories, if you will. But there's a part of me that believes that you might not have to have them so micromanaged down to the level that they are. But I've also served on the board of the Lakeville Area Arts Center for years, and we have a big art sale there, and artists have very particular feelings about their crafts and, you know, how they're evaluated, et cetera. And so, I mean, I understand the conundrum that you're in, but I'd hope that the number of committees would be minimized to the extent possible.
Okay. So we'll keep the authority and, you know, keep looking at this one, I guess. So I just want to point out that there's a couple of other repeal recommendations that we have. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
In here that we didn't go over because I think the department's on board, or it seemed fairly straightforward. I just want to raise that in case anybody wanted to question that. And I don't see any questions. So thank you, everybody. We are adjourned.